Chapter 12. Also created a situation. They have created a situation in the East which they are competent to manage by themselves. And in doing this, they have brought about a change in the condition of the West with which Europe is not well prepared to deal. The common ground of concord, good faith and justice is not sufficient to establish an action upon, since the conscience of, but very few men amongst us, and of no single Western nation as yet, will brook the restraint of abstract ideas, as against the fascination of a material advantage. And eagle-eyed wisdom alone cannot take the lead of human action, which in its nature must forever remain short-sighted. The trouble of the civilized world is the want of a common conservative principle abstract enough to give the impulse, practical enough to form the rallying point of international action tending towards the restraint of particular ambitions. Peace tribunals instituted for the greater glory of war will not replace it. Whether such a principle exists, who can say? If it does not, then it ought to be invented. A sage with a sense of humor and a heart of compassion should set about it without loss of time, and a solemn prophet full of words and fire ought to be given the task of preparing the minds. So far there is no trace of such a principle anywhere in sight. Even its plausible imitations, never very effective, have disappeared long ago before the doctrine of national aspirations. Illinois Nye plus Europe, there is only an armed and trading continent, the home of slowly maturing economical contests for life and death, and of loudly proclaimed worldwide ambitions. There are also other ambitions not so loud, but deeply rooted in the envious acquisitive temperament of the last corner amongst the great powers of the continent, whose feet are not exactly in the ocean not yet, and whose head is very high up in Pomerania, the breeding place of such precious grenadiers, that Prince Bismarck, whom it is a pleasure to quote, would not have given the bones of one of them for the settlement of the old Eastern question. But times have changed, since, by way of keeping up, I suppose, some old barbaric German rite, the faithful servant of the Hohenzollerns, was buried alive to celebrate the accession of a new emperor. Already the voice of surmises has been heard hinting tentatively at a possible regrouping of European powers. The alliance of the three empires is supposed possible. And it may be possible. The myth of Russia's power is dying very hard enough for that combination to take place, such as the fascination that a discredited show of numbers will still exercise upon the imagination of a people trained to the worship of force. Germany may be willing to lend its support to a tottering autocracy for the sake of an undisputed first place, and of a preponderating voice in the settlement of every question in that southeast of Europe which merges into Asia. No principle being involved in such an alliance of mere expediency, it would never be allowed to stand in the way of Germany's other ambitions. The fall of autocracy would bring its restraint automatically to an end. Thus it may be believed that the support Russian despotism may get from its once humble friend and client will not be stamped by that thoroughness which is supposed to be the mark of German superiority. Russia weakened down to the second place, or Russia eclipsed altogether during the throes of her regeneration, will answer equally well the plans of German policy which are many and various and often incredible, though the aim of them all is the same. Aggrandizement of territory and influence, with no regard to right and justice, either in the East or in the West. For that and no other is the true note of your Weltpolitik which desires to live. The German eagle with a Prussian head looks all round the horizon, not so much for something to do that would count for good in the records of the earth, as simply for something good to get. He gazes upon the land, and upon the sea with the same covetous steadiness, for he has become of late a maritime eagle, and has learned to box the compass. He gazes north and south, and east and west, and is inclined to look intemperately upon the waters of the Mediterranean when they are blue. The disappearance of the Russian phantom has given a foreboding of unwonted freedom to the Weltpolitik. According to the national tendency, this assumption of imperial impulses would run into the grotesque were it not for the spikes of the Pickel hops peeping out grimly from behind. Germany's attitude proves that no peace for the earth can be found in the expansion of material interests which she seems to have adopted exclusively as her only aim, ideal, and watchword. For the use of those who gaze half unbelieving at the passing away of the Russian phantom, part ghoul, part djinn, part old man of the sea, and wait half doubting for the birth of a nation's soul in this age which knows no miracles, the once famous saying of poor Gambetta, tribune of the people who was simple and believed in the main injustice of things, may be adapted in the shape of a warning that, so far as a future of liberty, concord, and justice is concerned, le Prussianisme vaut l'ennemi. The crime of partition 1919, at the end of the 18th century, when the partition of Poland had become an accomplished fact, the world qualified it at once as a crime. This strong condemnation proceeded, of course, from the west of Europe. The powers of the center, Prussia and Austria, were not likely to admit that this spoliation fell into the category of acts morally reprehensible and carrying the taint of antisocial guilt. As to Russia, the third party to the crime and the originator of the scheme, she had no national conscience at the time. The will of its rulers was always accepted by the people as the expression of an omnipotence derived directly from God. As an act of mere conquest, the best excuse for the partition lay simply in the fact that it happened to be possible. There was the plunder and there was the opportunity to get hold of it. Catherine the Great looked upon this extension of her dominions with a cynical satisfaction. Her political argument that the destruction of Poland meant the repression of revolutionary ideas and the checking of the spread of Jacobinism in Europe was a characteristically impudent pretense. There may have been minds here and there amongst the Russians that perceived, or perhaps only felt, that by the annexation of the greater part of the Polish Republic Russia approached nearer to the comedy of civilized nations and ceased, at least territorially, to be an Asiatic power. It was only after the partition of Poland that Russia began to play a great part in Europe. To such statesmen as he had then, that act of brigandage must have appeared inspired by great political wisdom. The King of Prussia, faithful to the ruling principle of his life, wished simply to aggrandize his dominions at a much smaller cost and at much less risk than he could have done in any other direction. For at that time Poland and was perfectly defenseless from a material point of view, and more than ever, perhaps, inclined to put its faith in humanitarian illusions. Morally, the Republic was in a state of ferment and consequent weakness, which so often accompanies the period of social reform. The strength arrayed against her was just then overwhelming. I mean the comparatively honest, because open, strength of armed forces. But, probably from innate inclination towards treachery, Frederick of Prussia selected for himself the part of falsehood and deception. Appearing on the scene in the character of a friend, he entered deliberately into a treaty of alliance with the Republic, and then, before the ink was dry, tore it up in brazen defiance of the commonest decency, which must have been extremely gratifying to his natural tastes. As to Austria, it shed diplomatic tears over the transaction. They cannot be called crocodile tears, insomuch that they were in a measure sincere. They arose from a vivid perception that Austria's allotted share of the spoil could never compensate her for the accession of strength and territory to the other two powers. Austria did not really want an extension of territory at the cost of Poland. She could not hope to improve her frontier in that way, and economically she had no need of Galicia, a province whose natural resources were undeveloped, and whose salt mines did not arouse her cupidity, because she had salt mines of her own. No doubt the democratic complexion of Polish institutions was very distasteful to the conservative monarchy. Austrian statesman did see at the time that the real danger to the principle of autocracy was in the West, in France, and that all the forces of Central Europe would be needed for its suppression. But the movement towards a partition on the part of Russia and Prussia was too definite to be resisted, and Austria had to follow their lead in the destruction of a state which she would have preferred to preserve as a possible ally against Prussian and Russian ambitions. It may be truly said that the destruction of Poland secured the safety of the French Revolution. For when in 1795 the crime was consummated, the revolution had turned the corner and was in a state to defend itself against the forces of reaction. In the second half of the 18th century there were two centers of liberal ideas on the continent of Europe, France and Poland. On an impartial survey one may say without exaggeration that then France was relatively every bit as weak as Poland. Even, perhaps, more so. But France's geographical position made her much less vulnerable. She had no powerful neighbors on her frontier, a decayed Spain in the south, and a conglomeration of small German principalities on the east, were her happy lot. The only states which dreaded the contamination of the new principles, and had enough power to combat it were Prussia, Austria, and Russia, and they had another center of forbidden ideas to deal with in defenseless Poland, unprotected by nature, and offering an immediate satisfaction to their cupidity. They made their choice, and the untold sufferings of a nation which would not die was the price exacted by fate for the triumph of revolutionary ideals. Thus even a crime may become a moral agent by the lapse of time and the course of history. Progress leaves its dead by the way, for progress is only a great adventure as its leaders and chiefs know very well in their hearts. It is a march into an undiscovered country, and in such an enterprise the victims do not count. As an emotional outlet for the oratory of freedom it was convenient enough to remember the crime now and then. The crime being the murder of a state, and the carving of its body into three pieces. There was really nothing to do but to drop a few tears and a few flowers of rhetoric upon the grave. But the spirit of the nation refused to rest there. It haunted the territories of the old republic in the manner of a ghost haunting its ancestral mansion, where strangers are making themselves at home, a calumniated, ridiculed, and pooh-poohed ghost, and yet never ceasing to inspire a sort of awe, a strange uneasiness, in the hearts of the unlawful possessors. Poland, deprived of its independence, of its historical continuity, with its religion and language persecuted and repressed, became a mere geographical expression. And even that, itself, seemed strangely vague, had lost its definite character, was rendered doubtful by the theories and the claims of the spoliators who, by a strange effect of uneasy conscience, while strenuously denying the moral guilt of the transaction, were always trying to throw a veil of high rectitude over the crime. What was most annoying to their righteousness was the fact that the nation, stabbed to the heart, refused to grow insensible and cold. That persistent and almost uncanny vitality was sometimes very inconvenient to the rest of Europe also. It would intrude its irresistible claim into every problem of European politics, into the theory of European equilibrium, into the question of the Near East, the Italian question, the question of Schleswig-Holstein, and into the doctrine of nationalities. That ghost, not content with making its ancestral halls uncomfortable for the thieves, haunted also the cabinets of Europe, waved indecently its blood-stained robes in the solemn atmosphere of council rooms, where congresses and conferences sit with closed windows. It would not be exorcised by the brutal jeers of Bismarck and the fine railleries of Gorchakov. As a Polish friend observed to me some years ago, "Ill the year 48 the Polish problem has been to a certain extent a convenient rallying point for all manifestations of liberalism. Since that time we have come to be regarded simply as a nuisance. It's very disagreeable." I agreed that it was, and he continued, had are we to do? We did not create the situation by any outside action of ours. Through all the centuries of its existence, Poland has never been a menace to anybody, not even to the Turks, to whom it has been merely an obstacle. Nothing could be more true. The spirit of aggressiveness was absolutely foreign to the Polish temperament, to which the preservation of its institutions and its liberties was much more precious than any ideas of conquest. Polish wars were defensive, and they were mostly fought within Poland's own borders. And that those territories were often invaded was but a misfortune arising from its geographical position. Territorial expansion was never the master thought of Polish statesmen. The consolidation of the territories of the Serenissim Republic, which made of it a power of the first rank for a time, was not accomplished by force. It was not the consequence of successful aggression, but of a long and successful defense against the raiding neighbors from the east. The lands of Lithuanian and Ruthenian speech were never conquered by Poland. These peoples were not compelled by a series of exhausting wars to seek safety in annexation. It was not the will of a prince or a political intrigue that brought about the Union. Neither was it fear. The slowly matured view of the economical and social necessities, and, before all, the ripening moral sense of the masses, were the motives that induced the 43 representatives of Lithuanian and Ruthenian provinces, led by their paramount prince, to enter into a political combination unique in the history of the world, a spontaneous and complete union of sovereign states choosing deliberately the way of peace. Never was strict truth better expressed in a political instrument than in the preamble of the First Union Treaty, 1413. It begins with the words, "His union, being the outcome not of hatred, but of love," words that Poles have not heard addressed to them politically by any nation for the last 150 years. This union, being an organic, living thing capable of growth and development, was, later, modified and confirmed by two other treaties, which guaranteed to all the parties in a just and eternal union all their rights, liberties, and respective institutions. The Polish state offers a singular instance of an extremely liberal administrative federalism which, in its parliamentary life as well as its international politics, presented a complete unity of feeling and purpose. As an eminent French diplomatist remarked many years ago, "It is a very remarkable fact in the history of the Polish state, this invariable and unanimous consent of the populations, the more so that, the king being looked upon simply as the chief of the republic, there was no monarchical bond, no dynastic fidelity to control and guide the sentiment of the nations, and their union remained as a pure affirmation of the national will. The Grand Duchy of Lithuania and its Ruthenian provinces retained their statutes, their own administration, and their own political institutions. That those institutions in the course of time tended to assimilation with the Polish form was not the result of any pressure, but simply of the superior character of Polish civilization. Even after Poland lost its independence, this alliance and this union remained firm in spirit and fidelity. All the national movements towards liberation were initiated in the name of the whole mass of people inhabiting the limits of the old republic, and all the provinces took part in them with complete devotion. It is only in the last generation that efforts have been made to create a tendency towards separation, which would indeed serve no one but Poland's common enemies. And, strangely enough, it is the internationalists, men who professedly care nothing for race or country, who have set themselves this task of disruption. One can easily see for what sinister purpose. The ways of the internationalists may be dark, but they are not inscrutable. From the same source, no doubt there will flow in the future a poisoned stream of hints of a reconstituted Poland, being a danger to the races once so closely associated within the territories of the old republic. The old partners in the crime are not likely to forgive their victim its inconvenient and almost shocking obstinacy in keeping alive. They had tried moral assassination before and with some small measure of success, for, indeed, the Polish question, like all living reproaches, had become a nuisance. Given the wrong, and the apparent impossibility of righting it without running risks of a serious nature, some moral alleviation may be found in the belief that the victim had brought its misfortunes on its own head by its own sins. That theory too, had Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.